Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across Latin America, roughly 225 million people, almost half the population, live in poverty. Despite 25 years of growing democracy and often painful economic reform, the region's economy has been all but stagnant. Inequality has been the world's highest, and now the poor, it seems, have had enough. From violent demonstrations in Bolivia to the rise of President Lula's Workers' Party in Brazil, the poor farmers and slum dwellers of Latin America are flexing muscle. This week, the poor of oil-rich Venezuela embraced again the so-called Revolution for the Poor, touted by populist President Hugo Chavez. The rich are aghast. Some defenders of democracy itself are worried. But the poor are saying enough. Tonight on Point, Latin America's new Revolution of the Poor and the populist pushback that is unsettling a continent. We begin tonight in Caracas, where members of the well-heeled opposition to President Hugo Chavez have been clamoring for a recount of Sunday's recall election results, which went heavily to Chavez. Carol Williams is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She joins me now from Caracas. Carol, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So how is Venezuela digesting this big victory for Hugo Chavez on Sunday? How's it settling in?
Well, I think the reactions on both sides have been fairly moderate. There were, of course, celebrations by the Chavez supporters immediately after the voting results were announced on Monday, and there was a small demonstration by very disappointed opponents in that afternoon, but there was an attack on the demonstration, a woman was killed, some people were injured, and I think that has had a very chilling effect on public demonstrations of dismay over having lost the election.
We know there's fierce opposition to Hugo Chavez, though he won this election. What's the sense there in Venezuela, that the wealthy, the affluent, the middle class even, is just going to hunker down and live with this populist president who talks so much about the poor?
Well, I think that's what the international observers and the victors in this recall election would like to see happen. But the opposition, because of a climate of distrust and animosity that has existed in this country for several years, refuses to accept the results of the election as legitimate, despite the judgment of the Carter Center and the Organization of American States that oversaw the election. They categorically refuse to concede that they were beaten in a fair election. They're raising allegations that the Chavez government somehow programmed the voting tabulation computers to reject certain votes for recalling Chavez, and have at this point even rejected the results of the audit that they demanded from the international observers to recount the vote. They're saying that they won't trust it even if they do it, because they're unable to detect the kind of manipulation they accuse the government of having executed.
Carol, what's it likely to mean in material terms, political, business, military terms, if the opposition, which is by no means weak, just will not accept this result? Where does that go?
Well, I think it's likely to further weaken the opposition, especially with state and local elections coming up next month. Independent advisors, which are hard to come by in this country, are saying that they should move on, reorient their program, come up with some strategy other than just trying to get rid of Chavez to have some influence on the country's development. The opposition is fragmented despite having this united facade. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure within the very diverse organizations that comprise the opposition to, try something different. The military has already tried to get rid of Chavez. I mean, the military members of the opposition have already tried to get rid of Chavez through a coup d'etat in 2002. Mm-hmm. The business community tried to bring him down with its very destructive strike that began at the end of 2002 and concluded last year. And now the political members or political leaders of the opposition are going down this path of blunder, I think, by refusing to accept that they have been defeated in a fair vote by the public.
And what about the other end of the economic spectrum, Carol? What have you seen from the poor in Caracas this week, the poor of Venezuela?
Well, they are happy that their president, that the first person to lead this country, in their view, who has paid any attention to the plight of the poor. They see Chavez as being in their corner against a legacy of corruption and government that was very much directed toward the elite and the business classes. The poor haven't really experienced any improvement in their lives. As a matter of fact, per capita income is down, inflation is up, which of course
hurts,
inversely affects the, mm-hmm. the poor. I mean, they suffer more when you've got 25% inflation, which is the highest in Latin America. The only promise for the economy, I think, is that oil prices being so high right now, and in Venezuela having very substantial oil deposits, they are able to plow some of this money they're earning from record high oil revenues into social programs that are benefiting the poor. But overall, this is sort of a vote on what they hope will be a continued effort to alleviate their problems rather than any significant achievement in that area so far.
So they've got their man, but not quite their progress yet. Carol Williams, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Carol Williams is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Caracas. We are talking tonight about the poor pushing back in Latin America, from the polling booths of Venezuela to the barrios of Bolivia and beyond. Have you seen the streets full of poor celebrating in Caracas this week? Is democracy positioned to be the vehicle or the victim of the frustrations of Latin America's impoverished? And why hasn't 25 years of democratic progress brought more economic prosperity to more Latin Americans? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. He's been widely published and has testified before Congress on Latin American economic issues. Mark Weisbrot, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Also with us from Washington is Bernard Aronson, who was Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs from 1989 to 1993. He was Principal Advisor to President Bush I and Secretary of State James Baker on U.S. and Latin American relations. Bernard Aronson, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Mark Weisbrot, to you first, if I may. How do you interpret the results in Venezuela in continent-wide terms, region-wide terms? Is this part of a pushback by poor right across a large section of Latin America?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt about it. It is. First of all, this is the eighth election that the Chavez government has won, if you include the election of the Constituent Assembly, the ratification of the Constitution, everything else. And it's the third one that he's won by a large margin for himself personally. And I want to emphasize this because it is really a democratic country. We're here in the United States, we're used to the government not being really honest with us when they want to get rid of a foreign government, as they did, for example, in Iraq. They made up the stuff about the weapons of mass destruction and the links to Al-Qaeda. And so you see a lot of bad information on Venezuela as well. But this one really is a democracy. It's sitting on a lot of oil. No reputable international human rights organization would claim that political or human rights have deteriorated under the Chavez administration as compared with either previous governments or, you know, other governments in the region.
So we now, hear you flying to the defense of this outcome and outcomes before it, but give us the bigger picture. We look across the news wires, and we've seen election after election now and some violent demonstrations, and it just, we sat around the table and said, you know, it looks like something's really going on in Latin America. Not sure what it is, but as though the people who were kind of shunted aside in the barrio are coming down saying, hey, wait a minute, enough of this.
Absolutely. And this is a big thing in throughout Latin America. Well, there's been several elections in the last few years, not only in Venezuela, but in Brazil, where President Lula, the Workers' Party, won. It wasn't just him. All the other parties agreed in that campaign that the economic policies of the past had failed. And the same was true in Argentina, with Kirchner, also President Kirchner, they're also a populist, in Ecuador, Gutierrez. So you have a whole series in Bolivia. The left came very close to power. What is the problem? The problem is very simple, and it's not talked about very much here, I have to say. You've had 25 years of the worst economic performance in Latin American history. You can't even find another comparable period, even including the Great Depression. And that's not even looking at income distribution, which, of course, is the worst, absolutely worst in the world, but looking just at growth, looking at just economic growth. There's been very little economic growth in Latin America since 1980.
And, of course, those 25 years coinciding with Latin America's move toward democracy.
Absolutely, and that's why you see a lot of this. These movements are very critical of the United States because they see, democracy is, you know, obviously they're not, there's some falling off in support for democracy in some countries, although not in Venezuela, actually. They're one of the few countries where it's improved. But they're also critical of the economic policies, and they're critical of Washington because they see these policies, such as the, you know, the privatizations, the, more importantly, probably the trade and investment liberalization, the very tight monetary and fiscal policies, even during recessions. This is really, you can argue about what's the cause of this failure, but the failure is profound. You know, from 1980 to 99, you had about 11% growth in Latin America in terms of income per person. Now, you look at the 20 years prior, it grew by 80%. So even with the worst income inequality in the world, Latin America was able to improve living standards even for the poor. And then you have the first 5 years of this decade, you had almost no growth at all, about 1% for 5 years. So people there are really ready for economic changes, and that's what they've been voting for.
Well, some people are ready. Bernard Aronson, let me turn to you. You are not at all shy about acknowledging the situation of the poor in Latin America, but you're expressing a lot of concern about the political coloring that this pushback has taken, the populism bordering into anti-democratic movement, in your view?
Well, I don't think all populism is anti-democratic by any means. And there's no question that Latin America, dating much further back than 50 years, dating back 500 years, has been largely a rigged society and rigged economies, and the poor have been shut out of the economic life and the political life of the hemisphere. And I think the political elites of Latin America have drastically failed their societies and have largely, you know, with some exceptions, mimicked the values and the ethics of the conquistadores, which is they've taken out and they've not given back. And so it's not surprising that the poor have said enough, and with good reason. And I think that had a lot to do with Chavez's initial election and assumption of power. There was enormous corruption in Venezuela. There was no real significant increase in per capita income for the poor and no real development of a social economy outside the oil economy that touched the poor. So their aspirations and their grievances and their unhappiness and anger are all legitimate and understandable.
But the Chavez answer and others are dangerous, you've written.
Well, the question is what to do about it. There's one country in Latin America which is a stellar economic performer that has had among the strongest growth of any country in the world in the last 20 years, is the only country in Latin America that is substantially radically decreased poverty, decreased unemployment, radically expanded primary and secondary education, for its people, significantly increased access to sanitary water, et cetera, and that's Chile. And so you have to ask which models work for Latin America and which do not. My concerns about Venezuela are two. One is that in addition to spouting populist rhetoric, Chavez has been curbing democratic liberties. They recently added 11 judges to the Supreme Court.
Hold that thought, Bernard Aronson. We have to take a short break. We'll come right back and get your second point. We're talking tonight about Latin America's new revolution of the poor, the populist pushback that is unsettling a continent. Is the long age of oligarchs finally losing steam in Latin America or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the poor pushing back in Latin America, from Venezuela this week to the barrios of Bolivia and beyond. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you think the slums of Caracas and Rio would just take it forever? Is democracy going to be the vehicle or the victim of the wrath of the impoverished in Latin America? And why haven't 25 years of democratic progress brought economic prosperity to more Latin Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Washington by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research, and by Bernard Aronson. He was Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs from 1989 to 1993. Bernard Aronson, I had to get you just in the middle of your points there. You
sure.
were saying, first of all, populism has put pressure on democracy, in your view, in Venezuela.
Well, it isn't populism. I think Chavez has...
The Chavez brand, anyway.
Has systematically undermined democratic checks and balances so that they stacked the Supreme Court with 11 judges. They changed the criteria for approving judges to majority rule from two-thirds. They stripped the legislature's ability to approve the promotion of army officers. There are attacks on the free press, et cetera. And then, you know, you just mentioned there was a peaceful demonstration and an opposition person was shot to death. That isn't the first time that's happened under Chavez. It's happened many times. So, you know, that's the concern. It's not that he is trying to be a tribune to the poor. The poor need more tribunes in Latin America. They don't need more autocrats. There's a long history of strong men who try to consolidate their power in the name of the poor, who deliver both dictatorship and poverty to their people.
But let me ask you this then. What is Latin America to do? Its experience of democracy has not changed the income distribution, and their economic reform efforts obviously have not brought enough economic progress. I mean, how we see this UN report, we'll talk about it more later, but saying something like half of Latin Americans have lost confidence in democracy itself. If they look at democracy and say, you know, that really hasn't worked for us, i.e. the poor, we've got to break some china to make things happening, do you end up with Chavez?
You do end up with Chavez, and there has been a massive failure of democratic governments in the region to deliver a better life for ordinary people. There's no question about that, and that's why there's this disillusionment. That isn't because of a failure of democracy. It's a failure of the political leadership of the hemisphere. And there are lots of things you need to do about that. One is to confront corruption, which is rampant. One is to confront tax evasion, which is rampant. One is to end a rigged educational system, which starves primary and secondary education often in order to allow the elites to have more subsidized higher education. There's many things that need to be done, and the poor have a right to be bitter and disillusioned.
Mark Weisbrot, let me turn to you, if I may. Is it too much to ask in those circumstances for a perfectly tuned democratic leader to rise up to make these reforms? Is it inevitable that you get some broken crockery here of the kind that Bernard Aronson is describing in Venezuela?
Well, I don't think he's describing the situation in Venezuela accurately. First of all, to correct the record, they did not appoint the 11 judges to the court, as Mr. Aronson asserted. The Congress passed a law allowing those appointments. They've not happened yet.
Correct.
And so we don't even know if this will make the court less or more independent at this point. And secondly, it was a reasonable thing to do in some ways. I mean, imagine, you know, our Congress has the right to impeach the Supreme Court and would certainly do so if we had a military coup in the United States and that the Supreme Court ruled that the people who overthrew the government, the actual officers who everyone knows participated in the coup, simply could not be tried. So it's not as one-sided as the picture he's portraying. It's absolutely false to say that there have been attacks on the press. The press has not been censored for the entire 5.5 years, in spite of the fact that the press is literally controlled by the opposition and used as a political tool every day to discredit the president and the government. And right now, they're telling the people, can you imagine this? They're telling people in Venezuela that Chavez lost by a 20% margin. And this is why people believe it. And this is why you have the opposition still refusing to accept the results of the election after Jimmy Carter and the OAS and everyone's asserted it.
But
are the threats to democracy. Yeah. They come from the opposition, from absolutely the opposition refusing to accept the legitimacy of the government for trying to overthrow it with a military coup.
So you're saying the press itself is part of the kind of a wealthy business class that's opposed to Hugo Chavez. But isn't all this, when you lose confidence in democracy and you see it as rigged for the rich and then you push back against it, and you've got to get in there and do something, but could it not be done, or is it just impossible for it to be done to the kind of standard that Bernard Aronson would like to see?
Well, I think the problem is that you have a class of people there who had power for 40 years and they refused to recognize that they can lose an election. They've lost 8 already. And the bigger problem, or the second biggest problem, I should say, is that the United States government has supported them and encouraged them not to accept the legitimacy of the government. They supported the military coup and were very embarrassed about it and had to take it back. Mm-hmm. They encouraged them in the oil strikes, which devastated the economy. So if you took Washington out of the equation, I think you'd have a better chance that reconciliation would take place. But imagine you're in the opposition there and you think you've got the most powerful country in the world, and people like, you know, Roger Noriega and Otto Reich, who are committed completely to getting rid of this government. And so you're going to think, well, why should we
high American officials?
Why should we play by the rules of the game if the United States is going to help us get rid of this guy? After all, they got rid of all the other people they didn't like in Latin America, except for, you know, Castro.
And now we're reading, I don't know what to make of it, but that Washington may be holding some of its criticism, because if it has instability in Venezuela, it has higher oil prices, it has higher gas prices as we go into the presidential elections here, which President Bush obviously doesn't want. Bernard Aronson, we're clearly not finished with the political side of this, but we're talking about poverty here. I don't want to ignore the economic side. Democracy and economic policy are not the same thing. But does the United States have credibility to criticize Latin America after these decades, and you've been in the middle of it for no small part of that time, when the kind of corruption you describe went on? The U.S. encouraged reform but didn't really break the grip of these corrupting influences on either political or economic phases of Latin America.
Well, I think it's a great myth and a great distraction to think that the United States either creates the principal problems in Latin America or can solve the principal problems in Latin America. And frankly, I think that the perpetuation of that myth is a great gift to the elites in Latin America who did create the problems. It gets them off the hook.
But the U.S. has pushed for economic policy changes, hasn't it? I mean, it's been very strongly behind
And of course it has. And it, by and large, has pushed for sound economic policies. But very few of the countries involved in the region have deepened those reforms the way Chile has done. I mean, if you're a citizen of Latin America, your life is demonstrably better living in Chile today than in any other country, whether it's Brazil, Venezuela, Mexico. So you have to look at the policies that have improved the lives of ordinary people if you genuinely care about them. And those are policies that, in fact, are based on radical reform of the economy. But that's not all that Chile offers. It also offers a relatively non-corrupt society. The rule of law is respected, relatively non-corrupt judiciary, and a society that's been able to diversify its exports and grow its economy. I mean, too often the debate in Latin America is only about the redistribution of wealth, but you cannot do anything for the poor if you cannot make these societies grow and increase economic growth, increase wealth, increase productivity. Then you can have a legitimate political debate about how to use those resources and distribute them.
But it's hard to criticize Chavez on that front when his predecessors have their own record to deal with, and it's far from perfect.
Well, but it's irrelevant, I mean, to say whether clearly Chavez's predecessors failed or he wouldn't be there, but
yeah.
So what? You know, you have to deal with the reality of the country today and what works and what's good for its people and what does not. To say that you can't criticize Chavez because his predecessors failed is ridiculous.
No, only to say that his predecessors are his opposition. I want to begin to bring our callers in here, and we'll hear plenty more, but let's turn to the phones. Anna is calling from Boston. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Good to have you, Anna.
Great. I was just calling because I wanted to comment that I am an affluent Venezuelan, and I just wanted to say that I believe that Chavez is just a product of years and years of systematic racism and classism in my society. I was witness of economic repression for years. Not myself, obviously, because I am wealthy, but. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's just a social indifference in Venezuelan society, especially the wealthy people. They don't really care what's going on.
So, Anna, let me ask you, does Chavez look like progress to you, or does he look like a kind of a detour that's going to get the whole country in trouble?
Well, that's a really good question. I believe that Chavez is probably a lot of trouble, but I do also believe that at least he's talking about social change, and finally he acknowledged the needs of the people of the country, which have been impoverished forever.
So you say worth a try?
It is, and it's finally someone who's trying to give people education and health and all these different things that no one before ever even talked about.
Anna, thanks very much for calling in with Mark Weisbart. Anna refers specifically there to the race issue. It seems to be an issue in many countries across Latin America, an issue that's boiled up again in some of these elections and demonstrations in the last couple of years.
No, I think it's true. It's part of it, obviously, in Venezuela. If you look and you see the demonstrations in favor of the government and against the government, you see the different color, the much darker crowds. But also much poorer are the ones that favor the government. And you see this in other countries as well. I don't think it's exceptional to Venezuela. And I think your caller is right that, you know, the reason the government won is because of these millions of people now have access to health care and education and microcredit and literacy programs and even some land reform in the countryside. And that's, you know, that hasn't happened. And if I could just respond to one thing, I think I agree with Bernard about if you don't have growth, you really can't do much at all.
Right.
Even the policies that Venezuela has done are not going to be sustainable if you don't have economic growth. And that's really been the big failure in Latin America. And I know he points to the success of Chile, and I agree with him. They've been successful in the last 20 years, but they're one of only two countries in Latin America that have grown faster in the last 20 years than they did in the 20 or 30 years previously. And everyone else has done a lot worse, a real lot worse. And that's and I think not everybody's going to have copper and the resources that Chile's growth was based on. So an experiment of policy that works in one country out of a couple dozen or worldwide, a few out of 80, is probably an experiment that didn't work.
I want to turn to policy suggestions here. But before we do, we've got a call from Buenos Aires. We're joined from Argentina by Dante Caputo. He's director of the United Nations Development Program on the State of Democracy in Latin America. He's the former foreign minister of Argentina. Dante Caputo, thank you very much for joining us tonight from Buenos Aires.
Hello, it's my pleasure.
I know that because you're with the UN, you are constrained from talking about the outcome of the recall vote in Venezuela. So we'll set that to the side. But you headed up a very interesting study that came out in April of this year saying that Latin Americans are losing confidence in democracy itself in no small part because of the persistent poverty that's still there. What's going on?
Well, first of all, let's not forget that we have made a tremendous progress in Latin America during the last 25 years. Just think about the situation we had a quarter of a century ago only three countries were democratic: Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Colombia. And if you look at the continental Latin America, at least the continental Latin America, today all our countries are democratic. So first thing, we have done a very important progress as far as electoral democracy is concerned. But on the other hand, we have a very particular democracy in Latin America. Don't forget that we have democratic countries, but at the same time, we have very high levels of poverty, and we have, as you probably already mentioned, the most unequal region of the world. So we have a particular triangle there, where on one hand we have democracy, we have poverty, and we have inequality. And those three elements, of course, create a very particular dilemma for the development of democracy in Latin America.
Well, they interact for one thing. You went out and did polling. You found that only about 50% of Latin Americans now prefer democracy to authoritarian rule.
Yes. That's a rather optimistic figure. That is the answer to the question, which system do you prefer? If you ask that only question, just what system you prefer, you will have about 57% of answers saying that public opinion prefer democracy. But if you ask to those, for example, who have answered that they prefer democracy, if they are ready to support an authoritarian regime, if that regime could solve some of the economic problems in the country, you will find that among those who qualify themselves as Democrats, 40% will support an authoritarian regime, provided that that regime may solve some economic problems.
So deliver some results. Dante Caputo, let me ask you this. If then we are seeing a trend where the poor in Latin America are kind of standing up and pushing back against the status quo, in your view, is that likely to lead to more democratic governments? Is that what we see happening in Venezuela? Or less democracy in Latin America?
Well, I don't know. I cannot tell you what's going to happen. It depends on us. It depends on our policies. It depends on our capacity to understand our challenges. Let me tell you that, the main question we have to answer, how long can a democratic system resist this level of poverty and this level of inequality? So are we ready to solve those problems? And consider, I was just listening to your conversation, and someone said a moment ago that you need growth in order to solve the problem of poverty. Mm. That is correct. But on the other hand, if your economy may grow, not necessarily will solve the problems of poverty. You have some countries in Latin America which have had a very important economic growth and didn't solve the problems of inequality and problems of poverty. So our democracy will stand, will be able to survive only if we are able to solve the problems of poverty and inequality. Otherwise, people will say that they will accept an authoritarian regime, that will accept some level of corruption, because we have found that that's a very surprising answer. 30%, 30% of the population in Latin America ready to support a regime which is corrupted if...
For more prosperity. Dante Caputo, we have to take a short break. Mark Weisbrot, Bernard Aronson, please stand by. We're talking about the poor pushing back in Latin America. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the poor pushing back in Latin America. You can join our conversation tonight. A lot of questions here. Is the long age of oligarchs finally losing steam in Latin America? Did you think the slums of Caracas and Rio would just take it forever? And democracy, what about it? With elected officials, but no shoes, no money, is it surprising that many Latin Americans are losing faith in democracy? Is Venezuela's Hugo Chavez's path the way to more prosperity, or is it another kind of trap? And I guess the big question, what's the combination of economic and political reform that can break the continent's poor out of poverty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined tonight from Buenos Aires by Dante Caputo, foreign minister of Argentina, director of the UN Development Program on the State of Democracy in Latin America, and from Washington by Bernard Aronson, former assistant secretary of state for Inter-American Affairs, and Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. Bernard Aronson, I want to begin moving towards solutions here. We've heard Mark Weisbrot sort of critique the neoliberal Washington IMF line of development, and Dante Caputo said, look, even if you have some growth and it doesn't get distributed, you've got problems. What's your prescription here?
Well, there is no simple answer, but most of the countries in Latin America, with a few exceptions, are highly dependent on commodities for their export earnings. And that makes them very subject to sort of boom-bust cycles in the world economy. When commodity prices are low, they're doing poorly. When commodity prices are high, they have some revenue coming in. That's a lot of the story of Venezuela. If oil was $20 a barrel instead of $45 a barrel, I don't think Chavez probably would have won the referendum.
But it's historic high, and he has a lot of money to push around.
Yeah, absolutely. But he won legitimately. It doesn't take it away from him. But so they have to diversify their economies. They have to grow their non-commodity sector. That's what Chile has done. It hasn't fueled its amazing economic performance because of copper. Just the opposite. It's reduced its dependence on copper, and it's become a diversified economy which can export to Asia, to the United States, to Latin America. It's built effective capital markets, so there's capital in the country to finance development and growth. It's created a pension system which has increased the real wealth of workers.
But it's not easy to get there. And what about the argument?
Well, that's the big problem because, I mean, Chile also is a counterexample in the sense that a lot of the reforms took place under a military dictatorship.
So does it take a tough guy, a leg breaker of one kind or another, maybe of the Chavez kind, to push past the kind of entrenched interests? I mean, you could have development and still, as Dante Caputo says, not have distribution of that wealth and have the same problem with the poor.
Absolutely, but I don't think that what Latin America needs are more strongmen and either on the left or the right. That's been the plague of this hemisphere. So I would never support that as an alternative, and the people of Latin America deserve a lot better than to be told they have to choose between freedom and shoes. They don't have to choose that. I mean, I think you need to encourage social policies that, in fact, make the government relevant in areas that it's not relevant, in primary education, in health care, and in microcredits.
Where it's been inactive, invisible so far.
Poor. Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
Where it's been more or less invisible in many Latin American countries.
Well, in many Latin countries, it's not on the agenda, but I think that the rise of the dispossessed in the region will put it on the agenda, which is a good thing. The question is, you have to marry that with macroeconomic policies that create wealth and grow the economy and lead to diversified exports, or you're not going to have the resources to fight poverty.
Mark Weisbrot, let me put the same question to you then. On the prescription front, you're knocking the formula of the last 10, 20 years, privatization, trade and investment liberalization, formulas that in many parts of the world, for any number of countries, have worked. If we've got the rise of the dispossessed again, as Bernard Aronson says here, and it's not going to be Che Guevara, I guess, and communism this time on the lips, what's the formula?
Well, I think first we have to recognize that the formula of the past has really failed, and even some of the points that Bernard mentioned, the pension system in Chile, the privatization was a failure there too, as well as in Argentina and most of Latin America. And we have a paper on that, which I'd be glad to give to you. But mainly, I mean, the administrative costs of those systems are like 50 times what we spend on, say, Social Security.
Well, can I ask you a question then? You have a socialist government in Chile for the last 8 to 10 years. Why did they not change that?
That's a question for them. I mean,
it's the Chilean people, led by a left government, a socialist government, has maintained and deepened that pension system. That might suggest that the people of Chile disagree with you about whether it's failed or not.
So, what are you suggesting that where countries go? If you don't like the Chile model, you don't like the IMF, World Bank sort of globalizing model.
First of all, Chile's model is very mixed. I mean, it's not, you know, one of the reasons they succeeded is they didn't follow all the prescriptions. They had, for one thing, they had controls on capital, which were very important to their growth in the last 20 years, because One of the problems with just opening up to investment flows indiscriminately, as so many other countries did and Chile did not do, is it plays havoc with your exchange rate. Imagine the United States, if the dollar was flying around all over the place, how, you know, it would affect us as well, and it affects countries there.
We don't have capital control.
That's right, but we don't have the kind
neither
of...
Neither does Chile.
But take us to the point. You said, Mark, that Chile is not a model that's transferring to a lot of other countries. You pointed out its singularity. Well, so what is the path here?
I think some of the things that Chile did were successful. The capital controls is one. The lower interest rates as compared to other countries. Look, Brazil's got 16% interest rates right now. You think you're going to get growth? Imagine the Federal Reserve had, instead of 1.5%, we set interest rates at 16%. We'd be in a depression right now. That's one of the main things they did wrong. So what's the solution? The very simple one is to just have low interest rates like they used to have in the past. And the problem is that, you know, the financial markets don't like that. The IMF doesn't like it. But they're going to have to do these kinds of things. And they're going to have to spend money when the government's going to have to spend money when it has to get out of a recession rather than cutting back. Again, the kind of things that we do here. You know, we responded to our recession by both lowering interest rates and increasing our budget deficit. So these are the kind of things. And they have to have a development policy. Like Bernard said, they can't just rely on certain commodities. Well, you have to have some kind of development policy to get from producing, you know, being dependent completely on agro exports. And moving into something with higher value added. But those are the things that have been eliminated in the last 20 years, and that's one of the reasons why you've had more than two decades of economic failure.
And then you've got to have the political will to spread it around. John's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm also a recent Venezuelan emigre, and I've been watching the events going on with this recall election very closely. And my father was actually a volunteer taking part in the recall.
On what side, John?
On the opposition.
Okay.
Because one of the things I think that's being overlooked is the fact that even though the preliminary indications by the international observers are that Chavez had won, and you know the international press ran with that for a couple of days, the fact is that Gaviria and Jimmy Carter has still not left Venezuela. Because enough indices of fraud have surfaced to cause them to stay on the ground and begin to conduct a manual recount of the votes.
But neither have they turned around their conclusion of Sunday that looked like a fair outcome, at least at this point. What do you think is going on in Venezuela, John? Well, a good thing? A way to finally unlock the poor from poverty or not?
To be honest with you, I actually had a chance to meet Chavez as a reporter for Dow Jones in Venezuela
okay.
in 1998.
Yo.
And as a Venezuelan citizen, I voted for Chavez in his first election. And he came in on a huge mandate, which is the way that populist leaders typically take control of the Venezuelan government. And the issue with Chavez is that he was as far against the status quo as you could go. And Venezuelans chose him as a means to cut with the past radically.
So a triumph of democracy, then?
A triumph of democracy at the time of Chavez's election. Now, I want you to take a scorecard of what's happened in the Venezuelan economy as a whole and also what's happened to Chavez's victories in these various recall attempts as has gone on since that time, because his lead has deteriorated every time. And I believe that there's been a miscarriage of justice in this recent election because you even had reports coming out in the Guardian UK of independent exit polls overnight that were indicating that he would lose the election. And
So you're just not buying the outcome, and you're saying the economic performance hasn't been so great. On the other hand, he had to deal with all kinds of opposition by the business class and a coup during that time. You know, the old Maoist saying, revolution's not a dinner party. Do you think, John, as a Venezuelan, that the changes needed in Venezuela can be made without some messiness? And I hate to say without the anti-democratic movement. I don't know. How would you describe it?
I believe they can, because I believe that Venezuelans as a whole are coming through a catharsis of this Chavez rule. It's almost like a scorched earth policy where everything you had hoped comes to a screeching halt in terms of 25 years of decline of wealth and well-being for the people as a whole. And right now, you've got the opposition, and I believe 60% of the voters actually are opposed to the in this recall. And I think that'll come to light within weeks or months or whenever.
Well, it's certainly not the number we've got now, but I get the overall picture, John. Thanks for your call. Dante Caputo in Buenos Aires, where do you see things heading overall? You've described the declining enthusiasm for democracy, the continuing inequality and economic troubles there. Is Latin America's experiment with democracy headed into reverse because of these economic divisions?
No, I don't think so. I think we have new challenges, and we have to face them. We have to maybe we have to start a new debate in Latin America. And let me just make a comment on the Chilean situation. We found something very particular. We were asking in our surveys about the state intervention in the economy and about the market economy.
Mm-hmm.
And we found something very, unexpected. Well, first, 70% of the Latin Americans prefer a deeper intervention of the state in the economy. But which was really surprising for all of us was that the country which showed the weakest support for the market economy was Chile.
The most successful.
Which at the same time has the most successful market economy in Latin America. But only 38% of the population of Chile were ready to support the market economy. So what's going on in Chile? And that was a question I asked to President Lagos a couple of months ago, saying, well, Mr. President, on one hand, everyone agrees that Chile is really the example of a successful market economy in the region, but apparently your population doesn't think the same. And, he had a very intelligent answer to that. He said, listen, on one hand, there is something which is not shown when people talk about Chile abroad, that we have a very, very strong state. Chile is a very good example of a successful market economy experiment, if you want. But on the other hand, which is not shown, is that Chile has an important state, a very structured state, which actually has much to do with the economic success of Chile. But just I want to add one point here. I think we have two problems in Latin America, and you will see there are enormous problems. We have made not only political reforms, we have made a very important and deep economic reforms. Unhappily, the result as an average of those economic reforms in the regions are not very important. The per capita growth didn't change in 20 years, poverty didn't change, the concentration of income, the income distribution is even worse than 20 years ago.
Dante Caputo, so take us to your bottom line. We're almost out of time here, please.
Two main problems. The problem of having the illusion to solve those situations coming back to the populist regimes, or because of the failure, in a way, of the so-called Washington consensus, having the idea that the Washington consensus didn't work at all, and coming back to a sort of pre-Washington consensus. So the idea of coming back to the populist system, or the idea of the that we don't need economic discipline, are ideas which are really dangerous in Latin America.
Lots of dangers right now. I'm afraid that's all the time we've got tonight. That populist movement, on foot there. We'll see where it goes. Dante Caputo in Buenos Aires, Bernard Aronson, and Mark Weisfort in Washington, thank you to you all. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.